maybe 15.
WB2KWC with a field day comment.
Yes, Ken.
Okay. I know a few people were talking about power on field day. As of 2022, the maximum power that any class can use is 100 watts PET, so you don't have to worry about super high power stations at your field day site.
Yeah, okay. Is that just a local rule? Is that a global rule?
That is a global rule. It's basically in the field day rules put out by the ARRL, starting with the June 2022 field day.
Oh, okay. That's great to know. That makes a great deal of sense. I'm sure there are guys out there with their linears just itching to use them, but it certainly is a far safer mode of operating to maintain your equipment and such, because it just makes life so dangerous. With the occasional guy out there trying to throw full legal power out of his antenna, and you don't know where he is on the field with you.
AD2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
What an excellent level for that kind of decision and that rule to come into play on field day. I'm very impressed. That's the way things should be done. Thumbs up from me. KD2VHD, I'll be quiet for a while.
Okay, no need to be too quiet, but yeah, occasionally people get it right. I have experienced wrong so many times that we shouldn't get too jaded by the fact that there are people who are right. There are a lot more people, unfortunately, who tend to be wrong, but occasionally right does win out. And people with sensible propositions get listened to, and they make the rules for things. So, although it's a little bit surprising at times, I think it gives me a more optimistic sensibility than the fact that stupid ideas always seem to be the ideas that are followed.
I think it's very important that they be complemented and spread. Very important. Good ideas are should be spread and celebrated even. KD2VHD.
Yeah, I agree. It people should be complimented, and you should offer whatever approval you can to people who do things right. It doesn't cost that much, and it makes everyone feel better. So I have no problems complimenting people who get it right. I am a member of another club, and every so often we pick a few people who are doing the right things and give them little plaques and cups and all kinds of fun stuff. And I'm sure Limark has something similar going on. Anyway, once again, I'm AC2GS. This is still the Limark Technical Net. We still have Wesley in the chute, as it were. I get the idea that this is going to be more of a science-related question. So if there's anyone out there who has specifically an amateur radio-related question, if they want to ask it, hit the push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Ryan, K0BB.
A2NJF, Manuel here, Manhattan. I have a question about ATV. I noticed that ICOM is coming out with a 905. It uses FM ATV. I'm trying to wonder if there's any ATV activity here in the New York City area. Back to net.
about talking into the microphone.
Okay, Manuel, you doubled with someone else. I didn't quite get the other person's call sign. I hope they can hold off for a little bit. So I'll get to your question, and then we'll go back to the other person that I didn't quite get the call sign. My understanding was that this was not intended, at least on the when they showed it off, as a commercial product. This was more of a technical example where they took the 705 and they built something into it, around it. I could be wrong, but the last time I heard it was not. They didn't give any kind of a proposed release date. It was more of a technological demonstration. ATV is a very, very esoteric field of amateur radio. It requires a relatively wide bandwidth, and that requires more high frequency, so you're doing more point-to-point. You're not doing propagation, so you basically need another guy with the same equipment locally to play ATV. Now, in the old days, that happened. There was at least three or four. One of the people into ATV was our own Andy, WA2CDL. There was another gentleman. I think at this point he's in his mid to late 90s, and I think he's kind of out of the ATV business. So the problem is finding another guy to be at the other end of the connection. Hopefully that answers your question, Manuel.
Yes, but the unit you're talking about, it is available. It's going to be available out in the springtime. So it's not a prototype. It's an actual product. And in California, they do have a lot of ATV activity called ATN, which I'm going to check in tonight to whereby. I'm going to check into the ATV net. They do have activity. And I always wonder why the East Coast never caught up with the West Coast. I give it back to you.
Okay, that's good to know. When they first announced it, they didn't have any availability. So I guess they decided that it got good feedback, so they figured that they'll try and make a profit off of it. The problem is that, God love the West Coast, the much higher density of amateur radio operators. In sort of, I guess, the same way that in the old days, in the 50s and the 60s, a lot of aerospace engineers were working in Long Island, and so there were a lot of clever hams doing a lot of clever things, but all those places shut down. So all those places not only shut down, but they moved to places like California. So if you look at California, California has gone through incremental call signs much faster than the West Coast. So you'll see, you know, they don't give people KD5 or KD6, I guess, KD6 call signs anymore. They've gone through KE, KF, KG. So there's a lot more of them. There's a lot of other activity, unfortunately, that's much more active because of that higher density. There's something called mesh amateur radio. They're using Wi-Fis repurposed for amateur radio-related purposes, but you need a certain density of nearby people who have that technology and want to use it in order to implement it. So it's sort of the same thing with ATV. If you have a number of people in the area because it's point-to-point, you can have a lot of activity going around. But on the East Coast, where there's much less amateur radio use and esoteric use, it's very difficult to find someone else with ATV equipment interested in being at the other end of your transmission.
Okay, yeah, I see. I was wondering just that, why it's not that much activity. I do have DMR capability in Fusion. A lot of DMR repeaters here, so I give it back to you, check it out, and I'm going to get ready to go to the ACV net by whereby. good night. 73.
Okay, Manuel. Yeah, I'm familiar. I have a bunch of hotspots. I do DMR, I do Fusion, I do D-Star. We have, I think, a guest on our Echo Link, Jeff AB6MB, who's net control for the antenna net that I listen on my hotspot through. So I wish you good luck. Ultimately, what you have to do is you have to find amateurs in the area that you can reach, point to point, that are interested in the technology. And if you find them, then you could arrange schedules with them and start, a little organization of ATV. You're not going to be able to do it digitally, unfortunately, on the internet. Although I'm surprised that someone hasn't started to do that as well.
Well, that's how I'm going to check in tonight, whereby you could get ATN1 on whereby, and I do check into the ATN net every Sunday night. They also have it on Tuesday net also.
Okay, is that a ATV, is that a television, a video net, or is that a digital audio net that discusses television?
It's an actual ATV net. We do video on the internet, and they also transmit on RF on California, on one of the high mountains.
Okay, but like I said, if you have a bunch of people who can go point to point, then you can do it radio. Otherwise, I don't know. I assume that what they're basically doing is transmitting their video signal to something like YouTube, and people are watching the YouTube feed.
Trying to hook up every ATV throughout the country, even repeaters, through the internet, and if there's any local guys that could do RF, they could link up to there too also.
Oh, okay, Manuel. That sounds interesting. If you want to send me some information via email, I'll take a look at it and see if I can put it up on a link page. If anyone else is interested, maybe we can kind of fan the fire.
Send you the information through the website, through your Limark website. I sent you the video, the ATV contact on YouTube, and you can contact them. It's called ATN. ATN1 on whereby is W6ATN, the real call sign.
Okay. Not quite sure how you can get there through Limark, because I don't think my email address is even listed anywhere on the website. I could be wrong.
Okay. I'm just going to have to keep posting on YouTube also. I sometimes post it on Facebook also about the different meetings.
Okay, like I said, if you're interested, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you send me some information, if it looks like I could put it up on the link page, I'll try and do that.
Oh, okay, 73. This is Intern Jeff going to QSY and going to check into the other net.
WHCDL Mobile.
Talk about ATV.
Brings back a lot of memories. What do you want to know?
Well, Manuel is out there. I think he's going to leave us soon because he has a net that's dedicated to ATV. He's interested in the new ICOM 705-based ATV machine. He wants to know if there's any local ATV activity that he could use equipment like that for.
that the icon that goes up to 10 gigs he's talking about?
I don't think it goes that far. I could be wrong. I thought it only goes up to something like 1.2 or something.
There's a new icon. I don't remember the number, if that's the one that you mentioned. It goes up to 10 gigs. It covers 2,300 megs, 5,400 megs, you know, the hand bands between 1 gig and 10 gigs, because we have a bunch of frequencies, and 10 gigs as well. And it's all mode. I don't know that much about it other than what I heard. I didn't see any specs on it. But the West Coast ATVs have been doing that for a long time, and they're into the digital amateur TV, you know, digital ATV, high definition. And I was not into the digital end, of course, that was before it came out. We were doing analog. We had a repeater on top of the World Trade Tower, an amateur TV repeater, which was built by Bill Steckman, WA2ACW, who unfortunately was up at the World Trade the day of the attack. So that took care of that. And I had his tower. He lived in West Hempstead. But I have not been on ATV in 20, 30 years now, at least. We're talking about in the 80s. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the model, according to ICOM, is called the IC905. It can go as high as 10 gigahertz, but it requires apparently an optional transverter unit designated a CX100. So that's probably what we're all talking about. I had heard of this mod to the 905 back last year for some ham show where they were just showing it as a technical gee whiz. But that's good to know as well. Manuel is really interested in it. He's probably off on the ATN digital net. I told him that if he sends me some email with the information, maybe I'll post it on the link, and maybe some interested parties can kind of revivify amateur television in this area. He was curious why we don't have it and the West Coast does, and I mentioned that the West Coast has a lot more higher density of more active bleeding edge amateurs than the East Coast does, because a lot of the engineering job shifted to the West Coast.
Yeah, there's a couple of factors to take into consideration, especially nowadays. And I think the West Coasters have a different terrain than we have. We have we don't have the mountains where we can deploy an antenna and transmit a nice video, a digital video, or analog video for a great distance. One of the things that, of course, you probably know already is the bandwidth of a TV signal is 6 megacycles wide, and that's always been the case. So the question is, where do the ATVs go? Because nowadays, with the FCC moving things around, we were operating on 439.25. But that's too close to the 440 band where there were repeaters, and you're giving a 6 megacycle wide signal. Of course, we were horizontally polarized. Everything was horizontal, and we needed an antenna with a lot of gain. But my ATV antenna that I was using at the time, which I still have, has 26 elements to it, and it gives around a 14 or 15 dB gain or so overall. So in order to put a good, what they call snow-free picture in, you would have to run good power at a higher gain antenna at a reasonable height. So there's a couple of things that you got to, you know, take that into consideration rather than just putting up any antenna and just transmitting low power. So, you know, it's a little bit of a job in that respect. Back to you.
Yeah, it's a bit of a speed bump. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things that go on the West Coast that I'm not quite sure go on the East Coast again, because I think to a degree the greater density of hams, Wi-Fi mesh networks that are repurposed for amateur radio. You know, it's a shame, but that's the way things are these days.
It's too bad that, you know, the ATVs that were active on Long Island have all moved on to the next life. And they were old timers when I met them. The only one that's still around is Mike Schirillo, and he, I think, is 96 now. He's still going, but he still has his ATV set up, but I don't think he's on the air. I know it's 9:22. Let me just mention one more thing. I was listening to you guys on the on Echolink because I was in a restaurant. Let me just unkey a second. Yeah, regarding the 9700 radio, I have the same one that Marco has. We were talking about that situation, and I said it is possible that you can overload it, but just like WY2U said, I was listening. You know, I didn't do any mathematical calculations, but you have to take into consideration, like he said, the free space path loss, the antenna gains on both ends, how much power you're putting into it. You could overload it. The chances, I don't think, are really that great, but it can be overloaded, because anything can be overloaded, any radio to a degree. I don't know what kind of protection they have in this thing. I don't have the service manual for my radio, but I will say, and let me unkey, when I'm on the 2-meter dinosaur net, I'm running a different 2-meter radio in the shack. I'm actually running a tube type radio because it's a dinosaur. And I have the 9700 also right alongside it. Now, each radio is going to a different antenna on the same tower. My Clegg tube radio is going to a horizontal beam on the tower, and embedded in around that beam is the 2-meter vertical beams that I'm using on this frequency for FM. And it's right there on the same mast. I never had a problem with overload. Even with the radio turned on, listening to myself coming back on the 9700, transmitting on the other radio, I never had a problem with it going out. You know, or just losing sensitivity, so. And I'm running, not running 100 watts, but, you know, given the distance and the spacing and the antennas, running two beams, even though they're cross-polarized. So, just to let you know. All right, back to you, WHCDO. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thanks for that. Yeah, I agree in principle and in theory. You could overload anything. It's just that I can't see for the life of me how 10 watts 10 feet away is going to pump enough watts. And I understand what Mike said, and he did the math. I'm always a little curious when you start to figure in the gain of an antenna. It's a passive gain. It's not like an amplifier gain. It's just putting the signal through a narrower dispersion. So it's not like you're doubling the actual energy. The energy is given by the transmitter. You're just distributing it differently. So, you know, I understand the math. I just don't quite understand the where an antenna gain really functions. You know, so basically, if you have a directional Yagi that's 10 decibel of gain, and you have a 10 watt emission, it's like 100 watts. Well, generally, it's like 100 watts in the dispersion. But when you get to the receiver, I don't see how it's getting 100 watts if the antenna is putting out 10 watts. So I don't know how antenna gain factors into that equation.
Yeah, we did some tests in the subways when we were doing the coverage testing. But I guess that's the reason, maybe Mike will come back, that's the reason why they... You know, they label that effective radiated power, which you've heard it before. You've heard that expression. What are the effectives? And what does that mean? Effective radiated power. You know, that's putting the gain of the antenna into consideration. The same thing. You know, I guess the form of reciprocity would be the same for the receive end. You have an antenna that has a gain to it, just like a beam has gain, as you know. But like you say, it's the physical structure of the antenna. It's where it's located in relation to the other antenna. It's the distance between the antennas, the free space path loss, which, you know, was calculated, the power and everything else. But at this repeater, at H5, there's a high power transmitter at the site on a completely different frequency, but on a VHF frequency, and we do see at the time we saw power coming back on a per watt meter that's being radiated from an antenna that's not too far away, and you can actually see the power coming back. We saw like either a couple of hundred milliwatts, maybe a watt or two, or less power coming back. Anyway, I'll get back to you, and I'm out here at another stop, so I'm going to go inside. I'll talk to you over the week, W2CDL, and if Mike comes on, he can continue.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Andy. And hopefully Rocco will do the little experiment with his watt meter. I'm kind of surprised he has a watt meter that reads less than a watt, but we'll see what the numbers come back as. Again, I'm not a betting man, but I probably would bet a couple of bucks that it's not going to be a watt. It's not going to be a tenth of a watt, but we'll see. It'll be interesting, and that's the idea, among many other things, to learn things, learn new things. So thanks, Andy.
I'm noticing some static on the repeater. I don't know if you are. It's not your signal. I think it's the repeater itself. It's on everyone. You notice that?
Very, very slightly, I do.
It depends on how strong you're getting into it. Maybe I'm stronger. I'm in the car. Although you're getting into it quite well as well. All right, thanks. I'll talk to you. WHCDL. I'm leaving the car.
Okay, very good, Andy. So let's get back to the person who kind of doubled with Manuel. All I was able to get was the last two letters were BD. So if you have a question tonight and you have a call sign that ends in BD, I wasn't able to recognize because you doubled with Manuel. But if you're still there and you got a question, please hit that push to talk.
It's Ryan, Kilo Zero, Bravo, Bravo.
Okay, Ryan, what's your question for tonight?
Yeah, so I appreciate being on the net. It was really interesting to hear about ATV as well, which is something I'm interested in. But I signed up for the New York Marathon coming up on November 6th, and I watched, I talked to Deborah, KC2GPV, I think is her call sign, and she told me that I'd probably be assigned to a sweep bus. And I wanted to know a couple questions. One, does anybody have any first more secondhand experience with the Sweet Bus, because I watched her presentation to Limark and there wasn't much information on it. Second, what should I use? I have several radios, DMR capable, amplifiers, batteries, all sorts of things. What should I use in this situation? And then I have sort of an ideal situation that I would do on a bus, having driven buses before. But I wanted to know what people thought about that in terms of the equipment or experience. K0BB.
Okay, very good, Ryan. I have no experience at all with the marathons. My other club, Kings County Radio Club, has a bunch of guys who every year are involved in it. But I doubt that they're listening out there right now. But if there's anyone out there who knows any of the questions that that Ryan asked, feel free, hit that push to talk.
WB2KW3.
Yes, Ken.
Okay, I would recommend an antenna that can mount magnetically on the roof of the bus. And as far as you said, amplifiers and stuff like that, not sure that they will be that handy, or they will simply deplete your battery. I guess bring enough batteries for a few hours, and that'll probably make the amplifier impractical. WB2KW3.
Yeah, K0BB with a comment.
Yeah, sure.
So the problem with that is that the buses, I used to drive buses, as I said, and the roofs on the buses are made of fiberglass and plastic, so they're not going to be able to use a mag mount. I had an idea of using some sea sucker, which are like big, kind of like the same suction cups you use to lift granite, and attach it to the side of the bus. And do something with, actually, since the bus is only traveling about 4 miles an hour, I thought I would do something with a base station antenna. But I don't know. I have a lot of ideas about this, also with APRS and doing some active GPS antenna outside the bus. But I think there's limitations on what they'll actually let me do, so I was just interested. That's a good idea, though, I think, leaving the amplifiers possibly behind.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ken. Ryan, I'm glad that Ken was able to give you some input into that, and I hope you have fun. Enjoy yourself during the marathon.
KD.
Yes, I didn't get that call sign. Okay, Jim.
Just a comment, if it's helpful. I've found that suction cups on fiberglass vehicle bodies, I've tried it on my camper, work for a little while, and they somehow the fiberglass seems to be porous enough that it falls at the very least opportune moment. So it'll work for a little while. It won't work for a long while on the vehicles I've tried it on. It's obviously going to be differences based on what the fiberglass is made up of. But take it into account. KD2VHD, listening.
Yeah, K0BB. Yeah, I was going to say that I was going to try to attach this actually to the windows. There's pretty large windows on those buses. I don't know if they let me do that, but I think glass would be a much better adhere better with that suction cup.
Absolutely.
Hi, this is K0BB. Thank you so much for everybody's input. I think I've got some ideas. I'll wait until this week when I learn more about the actual assignment and the orientation, but it's good to know that there's some of my ideas are valid. So thank you very much. Back to that, K0BB.
Okay, WB2K.
Welcome.
If you're mounting it horizontally off the side of the bus, just make sure that it's high enough so that as you go by people or police motorcycles, you don't hit them with the antenna.
Wesley, you wanted to say something on the subject?
Go to B&H. They for film industry, they have a rubber, how do you call it, sacking. I have it, I don't know how to name it. Okay, so rubber sacks. No, rubber sacking, they have a 3, they have a 5, they have a 4. It's for holding the camera. Sometimes this camera is very heavy. So what you can do is the fiberglass is covered with some kind of enamel. The same story is with the metal. Let me jump. The metal is covered with the enamel, so the porosity is actually excluded by the surface area shape and surface area quality. And those sucking rubber stuff is going to hold. Just tell me the proper word for it. Enter again.
It's called a suction cup.
Thank you very much, suction cup. I have a problem with my English. Sorry. Okay, thank you.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
I think you recognize me. It was quick. I'm on the other machine. Say again.
Yes, I'm just responding to you, Lou. Please speak.
Very good. No, just to add a little color to what the other fellow was saying about the marathon and possibly using APRS. I'm in talk with Lou Melchick, 2RQ, about APRS. It's very good for the marathon, and they can show them how they can track, you know, the progress. However, he says there's a dead spot in Brooklyn, and just not enough APRS receivers or what have you. So as I'm listening to the net here, I am actively involved, actually since yesterday, in putting together a Raspberry Pi SVR dongle combo, which will listen to the APRS frequency and connect to the net and feed whatever it hears into the net. And that will be placed in Brooklyn Technical High School, and they have a high antenna on top of that building, and hopefully that's going to fill in the gap. So we'll more to follow. Back to that.
Okay, very good, Lou. Yeah, I heard you talk about your tinkering. I think it was yesterday or earlier this week. So good job. You should write these things up, you know, if not for QST, for at least the newsletter. I've gotten back to writing the occasional article for the newsletter.
Well, yeah, it's a little complicated. It's a deep dive. I mean, every step of the way, figuring this stuff is something else. But it looks like I'm pretty far into it now. It looks like it may actually work. I'll let you know.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate sharing that ongoing development of the APRS and another Raspberry Pi. And unfortunately, Raspberry Pis are getting scarcer every day. They're getting more expensive. I hope whatever is clogging the pipeline gets unclogged soon. Okay, that was a curious melody. Anyway, I guess, Wesley, you had some topics you wanted to discuss tonight.
say you have it. Okay, I'm gonna do me new talking. You're gonna be talking to Dr. Rose, please, because of my cords. I have a problem with it. It's getting cut. Anyhow, water and hurricane rotation into hemisphere on the equator. It's the first topic. And then we go to others, if you can comment on it.
Yeah, you alluded to a Veritas, I think it was a Veritas, yeah, YouTube. You're talking about the Coriolis effect, which does cause water to rotate when it's draining in one direction in the northern hemisphere, the opposite one in the southern hemisphere. The problem is that the Coriolis effect force is not very strong. So any kind of structural abnormality with the container that's being drained can confound what the direction that the Coriolis effect would cause. So if you have a perfectly designed draining area, you will see the Coriolis effect demonstrated. If you have a faucet, a sink, a toilet, a bathtub, there's usually so much variations that produce more forces on the water draining that you won't see the Coriolis effect.
Thank you for that. The only problem that I have with your comment is that you used the word force. The Coriolis effect is not a force. It is a consequence of the Earth rotation that causes the large-scale atmospheric events like a mid-latitude cyclones or hurricanes to rotate counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere and clockwise in the southern hemisphere. Do you agree with that?
The term, I think, is a pseudo-force, in the same way that centrifugal force is a pseudo-force. You know, there's unfortunately a lot of things that appear due to your frame of reference as a force that isn't a force. I was being rather quick in describing it, but you are quite correct. It is not a true force.
I understand that if you choose something from the equator towards the pole, it wouldn't go straight because the point you were throwing it from would actually be moving at the same speed as the point you were throwing it to. So the ball would appear to curve while moving from the point to point A to point B if the points were directly across from each other. So whether you're throwing something or moving something using the Coriolis effect, it's going to be the same visual effect for it. Interaction.
Yes, I would agree.
Okay. Anybody has a question?
That was KA2UTF.
Following that same logic, if you threw a curveball in the opposite curve, would it appear to go straight?
Would you like to answer that, Wes, or you want me to?
No, you're talking.
Okay. If you curved an object on the globe somehow, it would appear to go straight if you coordinated the curve right, would be my surmise.
Interesting in its own right.
Yes, agreed.
That's all I got.
Okay. I mean, it's more of a theoretical construct than a practical one, because probably the accuracy of everything, and you have to factor in wind conditions and all kinds of fun stuff, and heat differences and all kinds of fun. But on a theoretical construct, that would be my best guess.
Yeah, it's definitely only an exercise in theoretical space, as are most exercises.
Yeah, and as we all know, exercise is good for us.
CACUTF.
Okay, Wesley, you want to go on? Yes, Wesley?
I thought there was somebody else.
I don't believe so. I think it was just KA2UTF.
Why driverless cars will have a hard time ever being realized.
Well, you never know. I mean, what we're doing is we're talking about technology that hasn't been developed yet. And, I mean, it's kind of difficult to predict. It doesn't exist until it does exist. So for many decades, people worked on the blue LED and failed until Nichia came up with the right solution, and now everyone's using blue LEDs.
What the scientist said about the second law of thermodynamics. It's good until it's good, and then it's not. Back to you.
WB2EAD.
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, I really can't stay, but a quick comment. There's a big difference between a blue LED and a driverless automobile. Nobody ever died for lack of a blue LED or one that didn't work quite right. When you're talking driverless automobiles, the stakes are very high.
I certainly agree with you, Ed. And so before people allow these things on the road, they have to demonstrate a really, really ridiculously high safety rate, in my humble opinion. That they've allowed them to be driven as is. I've seen more than enough videos where guys with Teslas trying to show off the autopilot show that the autopilot is more than willing to drive right into bicyclers. So I'm just saying that technology isn't perfected until it's perfected, and you don't know if it's possible, and you don't know when it's going to be perfected. But that was the only a similarity that I was trying to make.
And you mentioned the word autopilot. Can I make a comment?
Certainly.
With a true autopilot on a plane, if there is something going on that you're not where you're supposed to be, air traffic control is watching you, and they will let you know. There is no analog to that in a Tesla.
Yes, that's quite true. There is no reference frame that checks your work. You're on your own, whether you drive into that bicycler or the pedestrian on the other side. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, we're talking now in the realm of heavy duty artificial intelligence and what it's capable of and what it's not capable of. And the specifications of the equipment required of any kind of algorithm that is useful under some circumstances. If you take a perfectly fine algorithm and you put it into a sluggish machine, you are not going to have an effective self-driving car. But, you know, I mean, who knows? 20 years from now, everyone could be in self-driving cars. Or 20 years from now, people will still be talking about the development of self-driving cars in the same way that we've been discussing how power generation from fusion is going to be available in 10 years in the future, since 1960.
And one YDY comment, please.
Yes, Hank. Always good to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you for recognizing me. I just want to say the part of the problem is the use of the word autopilot, which suggests to drivers that it is, in fact, capable of doing all these wonderful things. And yet, in an airplane, ultimately, pilots sit there with their hand ready to disconnect the autopilot, not assuming that it's going to do the right thing, number one. And much more importantly, the phrase autopilot and all these other driver-assisted features, driving assistance features that are being marketed as safety are, in fact, nothing more than, in my opinion, than devices which are added to the car to add to the complexity and the cost of producing the car and the profits of the manufacturer, and they sell them by claiming that they're safety items, which they're really not.
Last comment?
Yes, comment?
I just want to throw in a last comment before I go. AI.
Yeah, I didn't get your call sign. You kind of dropped out of the repeater.
K-A-T-U-T-F, you got me now?
Yes, I just picked it up.
K-A-T-U-T-F, you got me now?
Yes.
I contend that AI will never be perfected to the point of zero failure in real-world conditions.
Well, I would agree with you, Gary. The problem is human beings don't have zero failure either. Ultimately, unfortunately, whether we like it or not, people out there are going to come up with some number. I don't know what that number is going to be and what it's going to mean, whether it's 99 or 99.9 or 99.99, but they're going to come up with a number, and it's going to lead to problems. The bottom line is, will eventually self-driving cars be less dangerous than self-driving drivers? I think that's, unfortunately, in our imperfect world, the imperfect solutions.
N1YDY.
Yes, Hank.
Yeah, did my comment get through before? I believe that I accidentally became off frequency while I was transmitting.
Yeah, Hank, I got the gist of it. I was going to respond, but Gary wanted to say his piece. I sort of agree with you. I think the so-called self-driving, autopiloting, whatever you want to call it, is more marketing than anything else. I think it's, good old Elon doing what he does best, promising things he can't deliver. He's been promising this one for a long time. And if memory serves me, the Tesla only really started to take off well around the same time as he was promising self-driving cars, and you could rent them out as taxis, and you could make $30,000 a year on a Tesla just having it do taxi work for people. So I think it's a marketing ploy. It may surprise people to actually come to something at some point or another. I tend to discount it at least for the next 5 to 10 years, but you never know. People are doing ridiculously great things with artificial intelligence in other areas. So my respect for the field of artificial intelligence has grown a great deal over the last 10 years.
Enter HCN.
Yes, Wesley.
Sorry to interrupt you guys, but once I was giving you a microphone, I would like to finish what I have, and then you can actually go to other subjects if you don't mind.
Okay, Wesley, you can continue.
Okay, the second one was the fatal physics of falling objects, veritasium. So if you want to comment on it, it was a coin drop from the helicopter. We were less than a biostate building height. The water drops, hailstorm, ball, and it was compared to the bullet. So, you could say a few words about it.
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. Wesley is alluding to another Veritasium video. I really enjoy Veritasium. It's well produced, it's well thought out, and it's very informative. Dick, may rest in peace, K2RIW, was a big fan of Veritasium as well. This particular episode tries to answer the age-old question that if you went to the Empire State Building and threw a penny off of it, would the poor sap who's standing on the street corner right below you going to be killed by the concussion of the penny to his head because it came from such a great height? And so it ends up being a discussion of air resistance and other factors so that that objects falling develop what's called a terminal velocity, which is the final velocity where the force of gravity is equaled by the opposing force, usually of air resistance for the most part. And so pennies never build up enough of a terminal velocity to impart enough momentum to really hurt anyone. I think they reach their terminal velocity when you drop them in about 7 to 10 inches. So it's just, you know, it would be the same force as if someone just took some pennies 5 or 6 inches above your head and dropped them. It's not going to kill you. And he talked about the terminal velocity of other things and their air pressure and how different air pressures affect drag and the force that opposes gravity. And so objects higher in the atmosphere where the pressure is less have a higher terminal velocity in that area because of the air resistance being less, because the pressure is less. It was a very entertaining thing. They mentioned even bullets, that it's not uncommon for people to fire bullets in celebration and have them land back on the earth and hit someone and kill them. If they had a very nice diagram where if apparently you point a gun straight up and shoot it, it tends to pick up more of a wobble with a higher air resistance with a lower terminal velocity, as opposed to if you shoot it at around a 45-degree angle, then the rotation kind of stays and the orientation causes the terminal velocity to be much faster, and that's where you end up killing people. So that's a quick summary of that Veritasium episode.
Something in addition to it, the water drops is based on its shape, and the shape changes. The ball modified to the shape of a bullet, we have a little bit different because the drag coefficient for the ball is 0.5 and drag coefficient for bullet is 0.1. 2.03, so it's much less. And he used the wording which, due to my discrepancy or inability to understand properly English, I didn't understand. He said, "Bullet is no longer bullet." How should I understand that?
I thought he was just being cute with his pronunciation. The idea was originally a bullet designs were very reminiscent of cannonballs. You took a spherical lead object and you accelerated it. And they discerned that air resistance was slowing it down, and the most efficient design to pack that amount of momentum in a projectile would be more of a bullet shape than a ball shape. So he was just doing some wordplay there.
Okay, thank you for that. A dropped bullet from the airplane. It lands on its side.
and stumble in the air. But